This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Eleanor Hall. This Tuesday, Queensland police defend stripping an intellectually disabled boy naked inside Brisbane's adult maximum security watch house. And the future of work, how artificial intelligence could not only create jobs, but also provide better working conditions.
AI can be used in ways that no one has thought about before, and it's not something to be scared of. Very simple for people to understand, really. It just is like a brain thinking much faster than we are.
But first today, the minutes from the Reserve Bank Board reveal the decision to cut Australia's official interest rate to its lowest level ever this month was not an easy one. A key concern for board members was the impact on people with savings accounts, in particular older Australians who rely on interest from bank deposits as part of their income. The ABC's senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan, is just back from the RBA's headquarters in Sydney's Martin Place, and he joins me in the studio now. Peter, the RBA did decide to cut rates. What do today's minutes show about how difficult it was for the board to come to that decision?
Well, Eleanor, to say the RBA board struggled or even agonised is probably way too strong, but the board was certainly aware of the impact on depositors who'd been seeing interest rates on their money basically evaporating as the cash rate's been falling in recent years. In what depositors might see as a bit of an understatement, the minutes said that changes in interest rates can have, quote, different effects on different groups of households, but that members recognise that many older Australians rely on interest income, which would decline with lower rates. But as we know, regardless of those considerations, the cash rate was cut to 1.25% a fortnight ago, and the minutes show we should probably expect more to come if money markets are any guide, given that move to do what it takes to lower the jobless rate to 4.5%, and that's the main game. Money markets see there's a 54% chance that rates might be cut again in July, but most pundits are looking at August, then November on Melbourne Cup Day, which would take the cash rate down to 0.75%.
So do these minutes shed more light on the data that the board took into account to support this cut, and indeed that they will take into account to support future cuts?
Well, the big argument is getting that jobless rate, which is currently 5.2%, down to 4.5%. The Reserve Bank's reiterated that 4.5% is now the measure they see as full employment. But the bigger argument was based on the outlook for getting the Australian dollar lower, which will help exporters, reducing borrowing rates for business, and lower interest payments for households, which would free up other spending. And of course, one of the big issues about the housing correction and tighter lending standards is the impact on consumption in Australia, and basically the Reserve Bank wants to get people spending and spending fast.
So we've already got interest rates at historic lows. There's been a lot of talk about other measures besides lower interest rates to help stimulate the economy. Do the minutes tell us anything about that?
Yeah, the board noted towards the end of the statement, Eleanor, that lower interest rates are not the only monetary policy lever around, and that other options might assist in lowering the rate of unemployment towards that 4.5% we were mentioning. And they didn't actually mention the term quantitative easing. That's a metaphorical money printing, buying bonds and mortgages from businesses. But in recent months, the RBA Deputy Governor Guy Debelle has flagged the option of that quantitative easing to help stimulate the economy. And of course, that was used by major global central banks out of the United States and Europe and Britain during the global financial crisis a decade ago. But it's very clear that the Reserve Bank is, you know, focused very much on getting that jobless rate down. And of course, if traditional interest rate cuts in stimulating the economy aren't enough, and we don't see those anticipated tax cuts from the government coming, there may be what they would call more unconventional measures.
And the Reserve Bank's also been looking at loan arrears in Australia and the pressures on borrowers. What are they finding?
Well, to sum it up, I would say that they're probably alert but not alarmed. That's because 1% of Australian loans are non-performing or in arrears, and that's pretty small compared to other developed economies like in Spain, which is close to 5%, then France and the United Kingdom, where there's been a lot of unemployment post the global financial crisis. The question in Australia is why arrears are on the rise despite growing employment. And at the moment, 99% of Australian home loans are either on track or ahead of schedule, but we're certainly not seeing the levels that we last saw during the 1990s recession.
Peter Ryan, the ABC's Senior Business Correspondent, thank you. Well, as Peter mentioned, the Reserve Bank Board flagged today that the number of homeowners falling behind on their mortgage payments is the highest in almost a decade. The numbers are still low by international standards, but that's no comfort to those struggling with their loans, as Stephanie Smale reports.
29-year-old Sydneysider Amy bought her first home in the city's inner west late last year. It took 8 years of working and living at home to save up. She points out lower interest rates helped motivate her to buy when she did.
There was all this sort of hype in the media talking about falling house prices as well, and that was definitely a reason why I thought it would be a good time to purchase.
She explains owning a home has forced her to overhaul the way she lives in order to pay her mortgage.
When I first took on a mortgage, I realised that it was going to be one of my biggest commitments that I do in my life. It's a real challenge to just make sure that that money is in your account month to month. It is actually a massive challenge, and I have had to adjust my lifestyle quite a lot.
Amy says she's confident she will keep making her repayments and lower interest rates will make a small difference.
But it does sort of weigh on me that if I was for any reason to lose my job tomorrow, I don't know if I would be able to support a mortgage. That really does weigh on me quite a lot.
While Amy keeps making her repayments, other Australians are falling behind. Despite growing employment in most parts of the country, the number of home loans in arrears has grown to about 1%. But Chief Economist with Ernst & Young Joe Masters explains the end of the mining boom has left homeowners in parts of Queensland, but mostly in Western Australia, struggling. She points out homeowners in other parts of the country are battling a range of financial pressures too.
Lack of wage growth is one of a variety of headwinds that households are facing. We've also seen increased portion of budgets being taken up by essential spending. We've also got very high household debt, low savings rates, and now house prices are also falling.
The RBA acknowledges the amount of homeowners falling behind in Australia is low compared to other developed countries such as Spain, France and the United Kingdom, where high unemployment has been a problem since the global financial crisis.
That's partly because we've had quite an orderly adjustment in our housing market. It's also because we have seen improved credit standards in the last few years. The process by APRA commenced back in 2014 to improve lending standards, to reduce the number of low doc loans or high loan-to-value ratio mortgages. So we've done quite a bit of work in terms of credit quality, and that's supporting us now.
Jo Masters says there's some good news too. She says about 70% of Australian mortgage holders are about a month ahead, and about 30% are 2 years ahead with their payments. But she's warning falling house prices are something to watch out for.
We know from global experience that negative equity, which is when the amount of money you owe on your house is larger than the value of your house, has very detrimental impacts to households and the economy more broadly. In Australia, the Reserve Bank of Australia estimates it's just over 2% of borrowers here in Australia, and most of those are people that bought properties at the peak of the market. That number is quite low by historical standards. It's quite manageable, but something to be watching given that house prices are falling. A bit like non-performing loans, so the improvement in credit quality here in Australia is a positive in terms of protecting us from that becoming a wholesale problem.
And that's Ernst & Young Chief Economist Joe Masters ending Stephanie Smale's report. The CSIRO is warning today that Australians are facing a slow decline if we don't invest in innovative, high-growth industries and tackle social and environmental challenges. And companies that are already investing in innovations like artificial intelligence say far from shedding jobs, a human touch will be more important than ever, as Gavin Coote reports.
Oh, hi there, Rhonda. My name's Bailey. We're just looking to move our pump from Adelaide up to Alice Springs.
Working in some of Australia's most remote locations is part and parcel for a minerals exploration company. But this search for base and rare earth metals in the Northern Territory isn't your standard exploration job. It's the first to involve a combination of artificial intelligence and big data. As the automated rigs and drones make their way across the outback, a team of geologists and engineers is overseeing the whole thing from a small office in Western Sydney.
So we're very mobile, we can move quickly, and the reason we do this is because of our AI system.
generates results so quickly that we need to have a very agile team that can move to new sites anytime they need to.
Isabella Sykes is the Chief Operating Officer at Earth AI. She says the use of existing satellite and geophysical data and applying it with artificial intelligence means they can predict where minerals may lie for a fraction of the cost and time. But these efficiencies won't necessarily mean less human work.
And it's not something to be scared of. It's very simple for people to understand, really. It just is like a brain thinking much faster than we are. And we should use all the data that we've been collecting for years and years and years and try to find something new from it.
It's not just the economic benefits of automation that are being touted. For financial planner William Johns, the use of technology to shake up existing ways of doing things is all about providing a social good and saving people's time. He's using automation to speed up insurance claims, avoiding lengthy delays or people missing out on support due to administrative errors.
I know some people go and apply and Centrelink says, yeah, your application is fine, or the insurer says your application is complete, and then 6 months later they come back and saying, we've just had an assessment, there is something missing. So technology can actually highlight what's missing at the very outset, so that when somebody's waiting for 6-8 months, they actually get somewhere, not restart the process, because these people are destitute. They're losing their homes.
And he sees the use of automation as a way of growing rather than killing the number of service jobs.
Today I've had 7 referrals, and I'm thinking, what am I going to do with that? So I have to put more staff on, I have to...
How many do you have at the moment?
Got 6.
And you're looking at expanding?
We have to. I don't think there is a choice. Like, you become efficient to a certain extent with technology, and then you're saying, OK, well, if it's a service organisation, it has to have people who are doing some of the manual work too.
The CSIRO has today released modelling based on 2 years of research, which presents 2 possible scenarios of what Australia could look like in 2060. One would see the country fall behind economically, but the other would involve a rapid uptake of technology to make it economically productive and socially cohesive. And by 2030, the accounting firm Deloitte predicts a shift from hands-on work to the use of head and heart will make up 86% of jobs growth. Anna Sawyer is an associate director with the group.
As a social researcher and an ethicist, I really hope that the application of technology is really about social good. We wouldn't be, I guess, disrupting so many different industries if they weren't going to have some sort of positive impact on our communities.
Don Wright runs Western Sydney University's Launchpad, which supports about 120 startup companies, many of which use automation or artificial intelligence. He says political leaders have failed to communicate what innovation will mean for traditional hands-on workers.
You have to make it real for real people. So when we talk to manufacturers about Industry 4.0, we try to break it down to something very simple. It's smarter products, smarter processes. You know, we don't need to, you know, dress it up in a whole heap of mumbo-jumbo. So we'll work with, you know, fabrication companies, sheet metal companies, precision engineering firms to say, right, what do you have in your business? What data do you generate? And how could we actually use that data to generate new revenue streams for your business?
That's Western Sydney University's Don Wright, ending that report from Gavin Coote. This is The World Today. And if you miss a program or you've come in late, you can find the full program on the ABC Listen app. Or you can subscribe to The World Today wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at ABC News. And you can follow me at Eleanor Hall 1. Still to come on the program, a macabre tourist attraction. The dead whales washing up on the west coast of the US. While Australia's offshore immigration detention policies attract more attention, the federal government also detains asylum seekers in facilities here in Australia. And today, the Human Rights Commission is warning that conditions in these facilities are becoming harsher. It says the average length of stay has increased to 500 days and that it has concerns about the children and young people being held there. Connie Aegis has our report.
There are 7 onshore immigration detention facilities in the country. For its report, the Australian Human Rights Commission inspected 4 of them. And what was found is a big concern to the Human Rights Commissioner, Edward Santo.
Now is a juncture where we can say that Australia detains people for longer, often in more restrictive, harsher conditions than any other comparable country. It's really a question of our laws and policies.
He says the immigration detention facilities have been refurbished to resemble prisons over the last 18 months.
We're seeing more and more barriers and fences much higher, much more restrictions on where people can go within the detention facilities, and also much more restrictions on their ability to have contact with the outside world. To give a practical example, we saw the way in which a number of detention facilities operate now, where you have two people held in a room, a toilet, there'll be no actual wall between the area where people sleep and the toilet itself. So not only is there the indignity of using the toilet while someone might be in the room and able to see you, but there's also the risk of disease being transmitted.
Commissioner Santo says it's now routine for restraints to be used when escorting immigration detainees outside of the facilities, and that while Australia has made an effort to reduce the number of people in detention, the length of stay has increased.
The average period that someone might be held in an immigration detention centre is close to 500 days. And just by way of comparison, in Canada, you would expect that to be no more than a month. In the UK, maybe 2 months. The longer someone is held in really restrictive conditions, the more they will be likely to suffer in terms of their general health, but also their mental health.
The report also says most of the immigration facilities are made up of adults, but there are still some children and young people in detention.
There is also the phenomenon of alternative places of detention. So that's where families usually are held. And so there are still some very important restrictions on what they can do and where they can go. And we certainly saw some really worrying behaviours from some of the young people held in those sort of situations.
When you say some worrying behaviours, what in particular are you talking about?
Well, we heard that access to regular schooling and education for young people, which is so important for their development, can be irregular and there can be significant gaps.
Mental health professionals are alarmed by the report's findings, but not surprised. Professor Louise Newman from the University of Melbourne says the impact on the mental health of detainees has been known for decades, especially on children.
People experiencing depression, stress-related disorders, physical complaints, and of course we're all familiar with the very, you know, unfortunate deterioration of people into quite severe mental illness, but also suicidal behaviour and self-harm.
The Human Rights Commission report has made 34 recommendations to the Department of Home Affairs. Commissioner Edward Santo again.
The most important one, as we've been saying for many years now, is to only detain the minimum number of people that absolutely need to be detained for health or security reasons, and to detain them for a shorter period as is absolutely necessary.
The Department of Home Affairs says it's responded to the recommendations in a 12-page summary, and it can be found on the Australian Human Rights Commission website.
Connie Agius reporting. The Queensland Police Minister is today defending the officers who stripped an intellectually disabled Indigenous boy naked and left him for several days in an adult watch house in Brisbane. He said the police followed, quote, appropriate processes. But the Queensland opposition is calling for a royal commission into how and why children are being kept in adult watch houses. In Brisbane, Rachel Mealy reports.
Documents written by the Office of Queensland's Public Guardian suggest the boy has a neurodevelopmental disorder and fetal alcohol syndrome. The boy's believed to be 17 years old and was kept in the maximum security adult watch house in Brisbane in late March through to early April. Because he expressed thoughts about suicide, the boy was stripped naked by watch house officers and told to dress in a so-called suicide smock. The documents reveal that when he refused, he was left naked and given a blanket to cover himself. Queensland's Police Minister Mark Ryan says proper processes were followed.
Yeah, look, there's been a number of allegations raised, and can I say police have looked into this matter. And police informed me that all appropriate processes were followed.
The police minister says the matter has been looked into.
Police, first and foremost, care about the safety and well-being of people in the watch houses. That is their paramount concern. They have processes and policies to follow. If, of course, there are allegations and people want to make allegations, those things are investigated. And if processes and procedures haven't been followed, then there are consequences.
Last month, the ABC's Four Corners program revealed that children were being held in adult watch houses across the state because of a shortage of beds in juvenile detention centres. In one instance, a child was kept in isolation in the watch house for 23 days. Today, the Queensland Premier, Anastasia Palaszczuk, seemed to contradict her police minister, saying an investigation is underway into this latest case and those raised by Four Corners.
I've asked for an investigation into that. Those matters that were raised on Four Corners are actually in the process of being thoroughly investigated. I know Ethical Standards is doing that. But my understanding is that there's more to that story, so I might leave that for others to comment.
Queensland's opposition leader Deb Frecklington has called for a royal commission into the matters.
It is absolutely abhorrent that any child is held in a watch house for more than 72 hours. I'm absolutely disgusted that any child in Queensland is held naked for 4 days. This is unacceptable. Anastasia Palaszczuk needs to explain herself today. Anastasia Palaszczuk needs to explain why children are being held in watch houses for over 72 hours for up to 40 days at a time.
After this story broke, the Queensland Police Service issued a second statement to the ABC saying it had undertaken further inquiries and found that the boy did wear the suicide smock, but not in a traditional way, rather as a sarong with the smock covering his genitals.
Rachel Mealy reporting. Well, now to the grim cargo that's turning up on the US West Coast and mystifying scientists. Dozens of dead grey whales are washing up on the beaches, about 30 so far this year in the state of Washington alone, as Isabel Rowe reports.
Whale carcasses have become a macabre tourist attraction on beaches near San Francisco and further north at Port Hadlock in Washington state. What's happening is different from a whale stranding, where the massive animals wash up alive. These ones are dead.
So they're very emaciated, and clearly they did not get enough to feed last year.
Research biologist John Kalambakidis has been studying grey whales along the US West Coast for 40 years. It's the largest mass whale death event he's ever seen.
Up and down the coast from the breeding lagoons in Mexico, where the whales were over the winter months, as well as now being seen north of us in British Columbia and Alaska.
But researchers aren't worried about the deaths making a dent in the grey whale population. In fact, John Kalambakidis says they have the opposite problem.
The grey whale population has been steadily recovering and increasing. The eastern North Pacific grey whale are at kind of record numbers and represent a full recovery from when they were depleted due to commercial whaling. It would mean they would be much more vulnerable to any variations in the food supply if they're operating near the limit of that food supply.
Was whaling and the lower population actually allowing those remaining whales to live better?
Well, certainly populations that are operating well below carrying capacity, you know, typically have higher birth rates and lower mortality rates than a population that reaches that carrying capacity. You know, however you define that as better or worse.
Janine Bohr is the executive director of the Port Townsend Marine Science Centre, which is helping to deal with the carcasses. She says two of her volunteers have bravely agreed to keep one whale on their land.
They basically have run out of places to let these whales decompose and to study them. And so Stephanie and Mario have agreed to let the whale decompose on their beach. The smell is pretty intense.
Apparently undeterred by the smell, Janine Bohr says six other landowners in the area have since agreed to let whales decompose out the front of their homes to allow researchers to study them. The Australian Marine Conservation Society is watching the phenomenon in the US with interest. According to its chief executive, Darren Kindley-Sides, research points to warming oceans as another possible cause of a lack of whale food.
Warming water leads to a loss of sea ice. And we know that sea ice, particularly the edge of the sea ice, is really important for algae. Algae are the bottom of the food chain in the Arctic and Antarctic ecosystems. Those algae feed the small shrimp-like creatures that whales, like the grey whale, feed on. So, look, I would think that there is an impact there from warming waters.
That's Darren Kindleysides, the Chief Executive of the Australian Marine Conservation Society, ending Isabel Rowe's report. And that's all from the World Today team for this Tuesday. Linda Mottram and the PM team will be along this evening, and we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Eleanor Hall. Have a lovely afternoon.
Having power.
I've answered the question the way I choose to answer the question.
Getting what you want.
This can provide endless possibilities.
It can be positive.
There will be no cover.
Or negative.
When an individual portfolio is blowing up.
Money, position.
I'm a fixer, Madam Speaker.
Influence.
Who do you think you are?
Power in Australia. How does it work? Who has it? How is it constrained?
Never again.
We go to the top and begin in Canberra. Who runs this place? Get it now, wherever you find your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.